Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Alex Israel discusses Parshat Korach. Rabbi Alex Israel is a faculty member and the director of continuing education for the Pardes Institute. And now, Rabbi Alex Israel.
Thank you, Larry. This week we're going to talk about the very tumultuous Parsha of Korach. A parsha filled with rebellion. We see Korach, who is actually related, he's a cousin of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses, leading a rebellion, a front against Moshe. He brings with him, as we're told in the opening lines of the parsha, Datan and Aviram, who are two people from the tribe of Reuven, their friend On ben Pelet, and another 250 people who are described as leaders of or chieftains of the community. And they gather against both Moshe and Aharon, Moses and Aaron. And here is that we're going to see their slogan. This is going to be their campaign slogan, where they say the following: Rav lachem, ki kol ha'ida kulam kadoshim uvetocham Hashem, umadua titnasu al kahal Hashem. I'll translate that. Enough for you. All the community are holy. All of them. And God is in their midst. Why do you raise yourselves above the Lord's congregation? Korach sounds tremendously noble, coming with high values. Moshe, Aharon, he says, you have taken too much upon yourself. Rav lachem, you are the leaders. Maybe they even accuse Moses of some sort of nepotism here. You are the leader, your brother is the high priest, what is going on here? And more than that, Kol ha'ida kulam kadoshim. Everybody is holy. It would appear that the argument here is a very egalitarian one. We all want access. We all want to be leaders. And this is an argument, I think, which many people might identify with. Why does the leadership, we all live in democracies, does the leadership need to be invested in one person, Moshe Rabbeinu, who's going to be leader for 40 years? Many of us believe that there should be free access to religion and even religious leadership. Let the best man win. Or maybe more than that, like give access to everybody, let everybody connect. That's certainly how we act in the Bet Midrash, and certainly here at Pardes, where we let everybody have access to Torah. And in fact, the rabbis say that when it comes to Torah, that the Keter Torah, the crown of Torah, is munach v'omed, it is there, sitting there, waiting for you to pick it up. There are no access restrictions. One has to come and pick up a book, pick up a Gemara, pick up a Chumash, and just sit and learn. And it would appear that Korach's argument is a very powerful one. Ki kol ha'edam kulam kadoshim. We are all holy. We're all Am Yisrael. We're all the Jewish people. We all have sanctity. Who appointed you, Moses? Who appointed you, Aaron, to be the leaders of the community? That is the opening shot of the parasha. And we probably recall the story, which involves quite severe acts by God. If you recall, God ends up burning 250 people who approach the temple with the incense. And Korach, Datan, Aviram are actually swallowed by the mouth of the earth. A metaphor we'll come back to soon. One could even look at this parasha and say, what's God getting so upset about? In the final count, what we have here is people who are just requesting greater holiness, greater involvement. And why is God rejecting them? Are they so wrong? However, I think if we look at the text here, we will actually see that things are more complicated. And let me try and elaborate. The opening lines of the parasha describe this as a single rebellion, where Korach allies himself with Datan, Aviram, On, and the 250 people, all coming along with a single coalition. Is that really true? I think if you look carefully at the verses here in chapter 16 of Bamidbar, in the Parashat Korach, you will realize that what we're actually dealing with is something far more complex. There are many, many strands here which seem to indicate to us that we're dealing with a very, very complicated coalition, and not one which is unified at all. Let me try and explain. Moshe's first reaction is one of appeasement. He relates, and here you can have a look at verse 8. I'll read you what it says here. Moses said further to Korach, "Hear me, sons of Levi. Is it not enough for you that the God of Israel has set you apart from the community of Israel and given you access to him, performing the duties of the Lord's tabernacle and ministering to the community and serving them? And he says, now he has advanced you and all your fellow Levites with you. Now you seek the priesthood too? Who is Moses talking to here? Who is he addressing? He says, Shimu na b'nei Levi. Listen up, you sons of Levi. And he says to them, isn't it enough that you've become Levites? You also want to be priests? It would appear that a large group, Korach himself, by the way, is a Levite, and a large number of these representatives who come along with Korach are actually Levim. They're Levites. What do they want? It would appear they want to be Kohanim. They want to be priests. The difference, by the way, between the Levites and the priests is very simple. That the priests actually get, the Kohanim, they get to serve in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash, or as it was known then, the Mishkan, the tabernacle. They actually offer the sacrifices. And we're going to see the litmus test here is going to be the incense, the ketoret. The test that Moshe suggests is in the morning God will make known who is to him, who is really holy. And this is what you have to do. Take fire pans, Korach and all his congregation, put on them fire, pour upon them ketoret, incense, and God will choose the right person. By the way, the fire pans are simply sort of, let's call them like saucepans or maybe better, frying pans. What you put in the frying pan is coals. And then you take spices and pour them onto the coals. And obviously there is a wonderful big smoke which comes up, a cloud of smoke. Very sweet smelling, if you put sweet smelling spices there. And that is the ketoret. The ketoret, the incense, is usually brought alongside one of the sacrifices in the morning or the evening, the daily sacrifice, the Korban Tamid. And it is offered only by Kohanim, deep inside the tabernacle. This becomes the test. In other words, I'll take a stage back. There are a group of Levites who want to be Kohanim. They want to be priests. It would appear that the argument they have is not against Moses at all. The argument that they have is actually against Aharon, the high priest. Why is it that only B'nai Aharon, the children of Aaron, become the priestly class? And these Levi'im are saying this is not right. If we're already made Levi'im, if we're already made Levites, let us gain greater power, greater access, and let us become Kohanim. And that is the first group. As I say, their test is to actually bring the ketoret. God says to them, I tell you what, why don't you go, bring the incense, the ketoret, Aaron will be there too, and you'll have a, how should we call it, a showdown. You'll have a showdown. Aaron will bring the ketoret, you will bring the ketoret, and we'll see whose is accepted by God. If you are so holy, then I guess yours will be accepted. Why don't you go to God to find a solution? So that is the first group that we're dealing with here. However, there is a second group. And this second group seems to be led not by any Levim, not by Levites, but rather the tribe of Reuven, in particular, two characters, Datan and Aviran. I'll read you the passage. It starts in verse 12, and I'll read you the passage here, and you'll see that the language is very, very interesting. It says, Moses sent for Datan and Aviram, sons of Eliav, but they said, we will not come. By the way, in the Hebrew, it's not we will not come, but rather, lo na'aleh, we will not go up. We will not accept your summons, Moses. This aliyah, they lo na'aleh, we will not go up, we will see this becomes very much a turn of phrase which is used here, because we're going to see that the vertical axis in this story, you know, in this aspect of the story, is quite prominent. I'll carry on reading. Well, I'll repeat. Moses sent for Datan Aviram, son of Eliab, but they said, we will not go up. Is it not enough that you have brought us out of a land flowing with milk and honey to have us die in the wilderness? And now you want to lord over us? Even if you had brought us to a land flowing with milk and honey and given us possession of fields and vineyards, should you gouge out people's eyes? We will not go up. One could even read it more cynical or biting, where they say, "Af lo el eretz avat chalav udvash hevotanu," you have not brought us to the promised land. This group do not have a problem with Aharon and the priesthood. This group, Datan and Aviram, have a problem with Moshe. They say, Moses, You brought us out of Egypt. Egypt, compared to this desert, was a land flowing with milk and honey, and you promised that we would come to the land of Israel. You said we would go to a land flowing with milk and honey, but we are here wallowing in misery in this desert. We're stuck here. And the phrase they use is, lo na'aleh, we will not go up. Is it bad? It's bad enough that you brought us out of, ki he'elitanu, again the word oleh, from a land flowing with milk and honey. And they say, we will not go up. Their problem is with Moses' leadership, and that is who they challenge. And it's interesting that later on, the challenge is not through firepans. Moses repeatedly tries to mediate with them. He tries to talk to them. In fact, with all the groups he tries to. And when he goes out to meet them, he actually goes into their camp instead of, since they won't come to him, he goes to them. It says very clearly that Datan and Abiram marched out of their tents with their wives and their children. And it uses the word here, nitzavim, bolt upright. They are bolt upright. They are proud. They're not bowing before anybody. And it's that then when Moses says, listen, I haven't done any of this myself. By this you shall know that it was the Lord who sent me to do all these things, and it's not of my own devising. And he says, if the Lord decides that to open the ground and swallow you up, then that's the way it will be. They say, lo na'aleh, we will not go up. But in the end, they go down, right? V'yardu chayim she'olah. They go down. They fall vertically downwards. And it's very interesting that you have the second coalition, the second group, who are rallying against Moses' leadership. They say lo na'aleh, and they actually get eaten by the earth. I should add that it's very interesting that when the spies talk about Israel, they talk about Israel as Eretz Ochelet Yoshvehahi. When they're slandering Israel, they call it a land which eats its inhabitants. It's interesting here, these people who complain they are not going to Israel, they get eaten by the land. What does that mean exactly? Whereas the 250 people who come with the incense, they get consumed by fire. The fire which comes out from God, from the tabernacle, it would appear, very similar to Nadav and Avihu, and they are killed. In fact, the rabbis ask the question, Korach, who was he with? Was he with Datan v'Aviram, rallying against Moses? Was he swallowed up by the ground? Or was Korach with the B'nai Levi, was Korach with the Levites who wanted to be priests, who actually had complaints against Aaron? And the rabbis don't know how to resolve that, and they come up with a covering all basis. They say, well, Korach was swallowed and he was burnt. Both things happened to him. This is certainly a fascinating story, and when we realize that there are these different competing claims being made here, some complaints against Moses, some complaints against Aaron, we realize that this isn't just a unified coalition. Korach seems to be something of a public relations genius. Korach seizes a moment with a lot of discontent. Why were people discontented? Here, by the way, I'm going to relate to an interesting debate between two of the early authorities, early commentaries on the Tanakh, the Ramban, Nachmanides, and the Ibn Ezra. And they both debate what the cause was of the revolution in the camp. Ibn Ezra claims that what had changed and what led to this rebellion was a sort of a social upheaval. You see, until pretty much the Book of Bamidbar, it would seem that the leaders of each family, the religious leaders, the representative of the family who would offer sacrifices on behalf of the tribe, who would do that? That would be the firstborn. Maybe that's why God targeted the firstborn in Egypt. But the firstborn were the leaders. At the beginning of Bamidbar in chapter 3, we find actually the switching, the exchange between the firstborn and the Levites. In other words, the Levim have suddenly been appointed. And suddenly this creates a huge upheaval in the social dynamics, in the hierarchy of the camp. Who are the leaders? Who are the religious representatives? And it's at this point where many, many firstborns are feeling that they have been demoted. The Levim, the Levites, are just getting used to their new positions. Suddenly, Korach seizes the moment to deal with this disarray and starts saying, Ki kol ha'ida kulam kudoshim. We are all holy after all. Why can't many, many people have access to whatever degree of participation and involvement in religious life that they would like? That maybe relates to the first aspect of the story, and that's the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says it is the demotion of the firstborn and the elevation of the Levites which directly leads to this whole event. However, Nachmanides disagrees. Nachmanides says that it's got nothing to do with religious upheaval in the camp, a direct relationship to the story which we just left off from last week, and that is the story of the spies. Until the story of the spies, you see, the Jewish people, the Israelites, Bnei Israel, knew exactly where they were going. They came out of Egypt, they knew they had to receive the Torah, but they were en route. They were en route to the Promised Land, on the route to Eretz Israel. They were marching to their future homes and farms. Suddenly, with the debacle of the spies, they find themselves stuck in no man's land, stuck in the wilderness, stuck in a desert for 40 years. They are not going to enter the land. God has decreed them to death. For these people, their whole future comes crashing down around them. What are they going to do? They're simply treading water. They're doing nothing. Life is aimless and hopeless. And according to this, this is exactly the ferment which leads to Datan Aviram's rejection of Moses' leadership. Moses, you are responsible for the failure of the spies. You sent the spies. You brought us out of a land of milk and honey, but you have not brought us into a land of milk and honey. They say, but you didn't bring us into a land and you did not give us Nachalet Sadeh V'Cherem. All of those fields and vineyards that you promised us, where are they? We're not going to see a field and vineyard, we're just going to see barren rocks and desert landscapes. In other words, we see different groups with very different agendas. It could even be that Korach is the mastermind who knows exactly how to harness a wide range of discontented people, bringing them together in a single rebellion to give it greater momentum. By the way, it seems like there are even further strands here. For example, at a certain point, Moses turns around and has to protect his own integrity. Moses turns around and says to God, this is what he says, "Lo chamor echad mehem nasati v'lo hariot yed echad mehem. I haven't taken anyone's donkey. I haven't been bad to any one of them." And one of the questions that all the commentary says, whoever accused Moses of misappropriating people's donkeys? It would appear that on the fringes of this rebellion, Moses is being targeted for his lack of personal integrity. And he says, "I haven't had any lack of integrity." A lot is going on here. This is a fascinating rebellion. Now, by the way, if you read through the parasha, you will realize that there clearly is a lot of misery in this camp, because this rebellion, even despite the firepower with which God tries to put it down, the fire coming out from God, the mouth of the piha aretz, the mouth of the land opening up and swallowing people, the people continue to complain, indicating that there's some real issues here that have to be dealt with. But let's try and go back to the opening line of the parasha. The people turn around and say, "We're all holy. We're all holy. We should be given access." That's a call for egalitarianism. It's a call for democratization. It's a call to say, you leadership, who are appointed through some sort of hidden system of appointments, we also want access. And as I said, I think that many of us, I certainly, and I'm sure many of you who are listening, are sensitive to these arguments. We live in a democratic world. And we believe in equal access to all sorts of different positions, and certainly equal access to religious opportunities. So what do we do with this? So first of all, I'd like to make two comments here. Number one, with the presentation that I've just given of the multiple agendas behind the Korach argument, it is true that they all come under a single banner. They can come under the banner in power to the people. And yet at the same time, we realize that these are far from disinterested groups. Each group has their own interests. The Levium have been appointed to greatness to become Levites, but they want more. Datan and Aviram, maybe they are upset with the management decisions that Moses has made, but one wonders what's on their mind. It is clear that there are many people who are trying to further their own personal agenda, and their primary motivation is not listening to God. It is something that they have in their own minds. One wonders whether sometimes certain revolutions, certain political movements, which are phrased with very high language, as if it's all about principle, really come down to pressure groups and people furthering their own sectarian agendas. One wonders whether that is a good blueprint for leading a nation. Some of you might think it is. Certainly something to think about. I always think that if these people were so principled, then maybe God should have sort of let it carry on. Why is God so fierce in putting it down? And here I get to a second point, and it's not a point that comes from me, but I read this actually in the writings of Yeshayahu Leibovitz, brother of Nechama Leibovitz, and a famous Israeli intellectual figure. Yeshayahu Leibovitz is a fierce rationalist. He had a lot of problem with people coming along with theories that people, well, first of all, not Hasidic theories, that somehow innate spirituality, he had no time for that. But he also didn't have any time for people who wanted to come along with theories that the Jewish people are in some way superior or innately sacred. And he said this idea of coming along and saying, Ki kol ha'eda kulam kodoshim, all the people are sacred, and therefore we are entitled, he said is simply untrue. That notion sounds very tempting. The community is sacred. We are entitled to take part in the leadership. But he said that is not Judaism. What instead is authentic Judaism, according to him? And he says, well, if you just turn back to our previous chapter, chapter 15, you will see a very famous text. It's actually the third paragraph of the Shema. And it says there the following. You're not holy just because you're Jewish. You're not holy just because you're a member of the people or because you're one of God's children. That is not what makes you holy. I'll read you the line here. It says, when you see the tzitzit, u'zechartem et kol mitzvot Hashem, and you remember all the commands of God and do them, and don't stray after your heart or after your eyes, l'man tizkeru, when you remember, v'asitem et kol mitzvotai, and do all my commands, v'yitem kadoshim l'Eloheichem, then you will be sacred to God. Then you will be kadosh. What makes you holy is not just by being. It's not just by being a participant in the Jewish people or in the community of mankind at all. That gives you no rights. Maybe it gives you obligations. What gives you sanctity is actually listening to God. Says Yeshayahu Leibovitz, the one thing these people did was to demand. They demanded, because we're holy, we want this. We want leadership. The one thing they forgot to ask was, what does God say? They could have come along with a very, very different claim. They could have said, Moshe, you seem to have failed in your leadership to bring us to the land. Aharon, why are you the high priest? We want you to go and appeal to God and tell us what the word of God is. Is everything okay in the camp? God, what do we do next? That would have been listening to the voice of God, and that would have made them holy. Instead, they began with the premise that they were holy, which would give them a carte blanche, which would give them a free ride to do whatever they decided to do. That, says Yeshayahu Leibovitz, is not holiness. That is chaos. And that chaos is the chaos of rebellion, which has to be put down by fire. With those words, I invite you to explore this very, very exciting and turbulent Parashat Shavua. Read more. I hope you will see the strands that I've identified in the parasha, and there's far, far more to discover. I wish everybody Shabbat Shalom and to enjoy the continuation of your learning.
Thank you, Rabbi Israel. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send your comments to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.